Well, hello, gang, and welcome to another edition of National Bugle Radio. And today I have as my guest Reverend Mark Dankoff. Mark, welcome to the show.
Patrick, always good to be with you. We've got some interesting things to talk about.
So first, now I just released a show a couple of days ago where I was talking about, with Professor Richard Sloan, we were talking about the Green Party's demand for a recount in these three states of Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And I know you have written an article about it and talked about it on Press TV and elsewhere. So why don't you give our listeners your take on what happened?
Well, of course, this is very simplistic, as it always is on the radio, because we don't have time to go into all of the sources and all of the information to flush this thing out. But to me, what you have is a threefold strategy. Clearly, this is an opportunity for Jill Stein, who I don't believe even raised $3 million for a presidential campaign, or not much more than that, who instantaneously, over a period of 48 to 72 hours, suddenly was able to raise millions more than that in order to conduct this so-called recount. She claims that she is not trying to throw this thing to Clinton or to engage in anything that would strip this thing of its rightful owner, so to speak. And yet, of course, she is only challenging results in the three states that Trump was victorious in. I found New
Hampshire. And that would make the difference in the election. There would be enough electoral votes to make the difference in the election.
Exactly. And you have a situation as well where New Hampshire and Virginia, where there were a lot of questionable things going on in both of those states that Trump lost by very, very close margins, those are conveniently not a part of this recount effort. The whole question of how Jill Stein raised this money from whom continues to be a source of speculation. I have indicated to Press Television Iran that I personally think the fingerprints of George Soros are all over this, especially because one of Soros's right-hand men is involved in facilitating this recount effort with Stein. The other thing is the way in which the money has been raised. We not only do not know where this money came from, unless something has come out in the last 5 minutes on it, but as I understand it, much of the money, the lion's share of the money, was being contributed on the internet in the wee hours of the morning, when these types of online transactions should be at their lowest ebb. They were suddenly at their peak. And in this particular case, for hours, there was the uniform amount of $164,000 that was automatically coming into Stein's recount coffers every hour. Now, we know that there's something wrong with that. There is no way statistically that if you had individual donors who were legitimate, who were donating for some reason at 2, 3, or 4 o'clock in the morning because they couldn't happen to sleep that night, that you would every hour have the exact same amount of money, a six-figure figure, put into the mix. In this case, it was $164,000 every hour, and that amount only changed after some of this got into public purview, which also underscores how deeply this whole thing is being manipulated. But as I watch this whole thing take place, Stein will win in this, in the sense that she'll have some money to use for whatever her purposes are going to be in the future, because she has indicated on her own site, of course, that it's conceivable that not every cent that is raised would be used in this recount effort, which begs the question of how much money Stein is going to walk away with after this farcical procedure is over. Then, of course, this also serves to continue to facilitate the obvious agenda of the globalist elite to cast as many aspersions on the legitimacy of Donald Trump as they can. Mainstream media is jumping into this because they were absolutely embarrassed and strip-searched by the legitimate results of the election. And so anything that can be done to sow in the minds of the American people the idea that this thing was tainted, or that somehow, some way, this election result was courtesy of Russian hacking. That's the latest line, it seems, of the Washington Post on this whole thing. There's no evidence of that whatsoever, by the way. That also plays into not only the attempt to destabilize Trump by attacking his legitimacy in the public mind, it also serves the purpose of demonizing Vladimir Putin, which is something that the neoconservative media, the globalist media, and the cabal that controls that media, which also controls the American government and financial system and national security apparatus, that achieves what they want as well. So in all of these areas, I would quickly, as quick as I can, just cite a few sources for people to consult as food for thought. I'll start by saying that South Front has a new video. It's 8 minutes long, give or take. It's entitled Trump's USA, Global America, or Fortress America. If one watches that video, I would argue that with what is presented there, that gives one a good overview of what is at stake in this election and why Trump has been consistently the target of demonization by a Zionist globalist news media. And when we understand what South Front is saying in this video in regard to the real agenda in this whole thing, then this perhaps is more nefarious than we might have originally thought. And it also begs the question as to the Jill Stein relationship, not only with George Soros, but other hidden hands that have been involved in this process of trying to get Hillary Clinton elected for globalist Zionist interests all along. So the South Front video is one place to look. The Washington Post's spin on this whole issue of Russia and Russian infiltration into the American electoral process, making those statements with no evidence whatsoever being presented, and citing as the basic source for their story the legitimacy of an outfit called Prop or Not, which is an organization that nobody seems to know anything about. It seems to have been in existence for about 5 minutes. And the Washington Post is using this Prop or Not spin on both Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump to cast aspersions not only on Trump and on the anti-globalist movement, but the other part of this whole process clearly is to attempt to cast aspersions on American citizens involved in legitimate alternative media who have been saying all along that the mainstream media had been hijacked, that the mainstream media was engaging in literal agitation propaganda for Hillary Clinton, with all of her known liabilities and criminalities. They continued to do this because obviously Clinton, which I've maintained all along on Press Television Iran and on Duke's show on Rents and elsewhere, Clinton was and is the darling of the Israeli lobby, the bankers of Goldman Sachs, and ironically enough, the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton's version of the Democratic Party have become the front people for a preemptive war and for the constant use of NATO abroad to intervene in facilitating the regime changes that the banks in Israel want and that the American neoconservative national security apparatus wants. So this is where the whole study of Clinton's financial donor lists and to see how heavily she was being financed by Goldman Sachs, by major Jewish contributors. I think the top six or top seven contributors that she had are all Zionist Jews. And by the way, this isn't just David Duke pointing this out. This has all been in the Israeli media talking about this list of influential Jews in the United States, principally, who were major backers, who were the top five or top seven backers of Hillary Clinton. And this also dovetails with another area where the Jill Stein people and with the Hillary Clinton people and where the forces that are behind this constant demonization of Trump are also involved in promoting the cultural Marxism that has hijacked this country in recent decades, hence the gay issue in terms of gay and lesbian marriage, abortion on demand at any stage of the pregnancy for whatever reason, and all of the things that have happened in the legitimization of pornography in the United States. This starts to go in all kinds of different directions in regard to what is at stake for these people who are both scared and hopping mad over the fact that they were beaten in this election when they had been spinning every day and every night in a conglomerate media the notion that Trump had no chance, that he was a laughingstock, that all the polls showed he was going to get buried both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote. Where in terms of the Electoral College alone, it's indisputable that Trump won 308 electors. Basically, in principle, what we have in this situation with the Stein requested recount is obvious not only in terms of the dubious character of this process and the absolute non-existence of evidence to prove any of the suggestions that have been made about the legitimacy of the results in these three key electoral states where Trump won, but then we're also talking about the forces that are obviously at work in regard to trying to destabilize Trump's legacy and to ultimately try to destabilize his government once he is inaugurated via a brand of mass media demonization, the likes of which will look like a positive relationship with the press compared to what Richard Nixon was dealing with in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Let me cite just a couple more sources here. We talked about the South Front video, Trump's USA, Global America, or Fortress America. Richard Baer's The Democrats' Real Strategy in Launching Recounts for the American Thinker. Fred Reed has a terrific piece entitled Uniquely Talented, Only the Democrats Could Have Lost to Trump. And that was for the UNS Review. Dr. Philip Giraldi, the former CIA station chief and the head of the Council for the National Interest, has a terrific analysis of this Washington Post agitation propaganda. It's entitled The Fake News, Fake Story. That, again, is for the American Conservative Buchanan's publication. Tom DeWeese has one out there that's well worth taking a look at. It's entitled The Anti-Trump Riots Are a Smokescreen. The real goal is the elimination of the Electoral College. That's for AmericanPolicy.org. Mark Glenn had an outstanding interview with Press Television a day or two ago talking about Democrats hold U.S. law in contempt. Robert Perry, the Iran-Contra expose chief for Newsweek a long time ago, who's an outstanding writer and analyst for Consortium News, which is one of the outlets that was demonized by the Washington Post as a front for Russia. Robert Perry's article for Consortium News is entitled The Washington Post's Fake News Guilt. Outstanding piece. Jonah C. Alexis of Veterans Today has one out there that's just been out several days. It's entitled George Soros, Ike, a Potent Messianic Fantasies, quoting Soros. And then Wayne Mattson, of course, in a number of places, including Russia Insider, has one out there entitled Blasts from the Past Threaten to Undermine the Trump Presidency. That deals with the whole question of neocons being involved in a Trump administration and echoing a lot of the fears of many of us in regard to who's going to be ultimately chosen to be the new Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm. Which I want to talk about later in the show.
Yes. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has one out there, an open letter that he's written to Vladimir Putin. I found it on lewrockwell.com. It's entitled, So Now I'm a Russian Agent, where Paul Craig Roberts, of course, is referencing this absolutely irresponsible tribe, this trash, written by the Washington Post, attacking individuals like Paul Craig Roberts and Ron Paul, as well as demonizing legitimate alternative news sites. That leads to the last thing I'll mention here, and then we'll start really flying. Alex Christoforou for the Duran has one out there entitled, Ron Paul Destroys the Washington Post and Its Fake News Reporting. So those are just a few of the things that will inform our listeners as they start going into some of the different aspects of all of this. But again, as we start moving into all kinds of questions and discussions today, I find it noteworthy in terms of the actual results of the election that out of 3,141 counties in this country, Donald Trump won all but 57 of them. He won 3,084 of them. And then, of course, if the Democrats want to get into this whole business of who won the popular vote, that ultimately has nothing to do, folks, in this case, with what the Constitution of the United States says at present about how we choose these people. And when we start looking at the so-called popular front or popular vote, we're dealing with all kinds of questions about how many illegals may have voted in this thing, as well as in the state of Virginia, the actions by a Democratic governor there to engage in some sort of an executive order that, as I understand it, facilitated the right to vote in the election for something like 50,000 convicted felons in that state.
Yeah, at least that many.
So when we start getting into this whole business, and of course CNN and Wolf Blitzer and company, and these other mainstream media conglomerates are not going to get into any of that kind of conversation, mm-hmm. because clearly, as has been pointed out by Philip Giraldi, Robert Perry, Paul Craig Roberts, Patrick Slattery, Mark Dankoff, and a host of others, this is the beginning of the full unfurling over time of the absolute rage and the absolutely evil agenda of these corporate media conglomerates who, having been absolutely embarrassed internationally, are going to do whatever they can to recover their own standing with a public that is beginning to recognize that there may have been a reason why George Orwell wrote 1984.
Okay, well, so we'll get into these various issues.
Sure.
Now, I recorded a episode just a few days ago on the Green Party. I don't want to repeat much of what I said, but you raised the issue of the money coming in 24 hours round the clock at a pretty steady rate. Now,
yes.
I have no doubt that the Greens are engaged in this strictly to get money and maybe to get Democrat money in order to get back at the Democrats, because I know there's this intense hatred of the Democrats by some of the principal people involved in this, especially in Pennsylvania, where there's this history of really bad blood. My initial thought was that the money was going to be coming from unsophisticated Hillary supporters who think that this would overturn the election, when it's clear that there's absolutely no chance that it can overturn the election for reasons I'll go into in just a second. But the fact that it's coming in at this steady stream would seem to indicate that it's probably coming from one big single source.
Yes.
And again, the history of the Green Party, you do have, and in Pennsylvania in particular, you do have a history of taking money from the enemy of your enemy. And there's that usually was taking money from Republicans in order to who wanted to finance the Greens as an alternative to the Democrats. In this case, I guess it's just opportunistically they're taking money from who knows. I don't know if it would be Soros or somebody else taking money from somebody, not even here so much enemy as the enemy, but just opportunistically. It's a chance to cash in on this asset that they have. They have standing in requesting recounts, and you have to be on the ballot to request the recount. And so they have this asset, and they've been willing to auction it off to somebody. And who that is, I don't know. I had originally thought it was just going to be unsophisticated Hillary supporters, but if it's somebody like George Soros or somebody like that, you would expect them to know that there's no chance of overturning the election. So then the end game would be, well, they're not really trying to overturn the election, but, you know, George Soros or somebody like him to tarnish the legitimacy of the election, to make it seem tainted, that could be worth a few million dollars, considering everything else they're doing. I would think that. For the Greens, you know, they will come out with millions of dollars that they don't need for a recount effort, and that if you look at the fine print of their fundraising website, it says clearly that the surplus money can be used for other things, you know, electoral reforms. And they have lawyers who they've been using for years who are now going to be able to challenge all sorts of ballot access laws with lots of money, and I think that's their game. But I think at the same time, having done this, this is really going to sully the reputation of the Green Party as a whole, as Jill Stein. And so I don't know if it was really a good move for them. And I'm sure a lot of people in the Green Party, because this wasn't the Green Party that initiated, it was Jill Stein's campaign. So,
yes.
So I think that's what's going on there. Now, you started to raise the Electoral College. And I think before we move on to some of these other issues, why don't we address the Electoral College a little bit? Because according to some observers, what Jill Stein is doing is part of a move whose end game is the abolition of the Electoral College. And there's a tendency that people have to look at the Electoral College as either being in their interest or not in their interest based on the last election. And I think that the Electoral College has pluses and minuses, that a purely popular vote system would have pluses and minuses, and we should talk about the pluses and minuses before we just have some sort of knee-jerk response that the Electoral College worked for us this time, so it's good. So there are arguments for and against the Electoral College. Would you like to start this off, Mark?
Well, I'm not a constitutional scholar. I have done a little reading in regard to some places that I think argue effectively what has been the traditional case for maintaining the Electoral College. I'll just cite one thing in the air. The late Dr. Clarence Carson, who was a very prolific writer on the Constitution of the United States and on all kinds of things related to the history of the United States since its inception, has a, if it's still in print, I hope it is, has a primer. It's encyclopedic. It's entitled Basic American Government, but it basically says that the founding fathers understood that in the creation of the Electoral College, that they were trying to avoid the very thing that I think has been transpiring in the United States, and that is the fact that those who argue for so-called democracy, quote-unquote, in essence, even well-meaning people, have failed to understand the potential for majority lynch mob tyranny that would ensue, minus the Electoral College. And to me, when I look at the color-coded map of who voted for whom, not only by individual state in this country, but also within a given state, you can see that this is a situation where the supporters of each presidential candidacy, based on region, based on state, and so forth and so on, is quite obvious. And to me, I will say that if the Electoral College were to be eliminated, we would then end up in a situation where California, Texas, Florida, and New York would be determining the outcome of every presidential election. And when we look at those individual states, of course, where it goes our way, right, in terms of this last election, we would say, well, that's okay if Texas was popular vote. But that's a fairly short-sighted view, because clearly when you look at why the founders instituted the Electoral College, I think the checks and balances on the say-so of different states and different regions and different elements of each individual state are more, in my view, represented by the traditional Electoral College process than in the so-called one-person, one-vote rule that people like Jill Stein and Mr. Sanders, among others, argue for. And when you look at California, Florida, and New York, it even goes a little more deeply than that. It is that when you look at those states, do we want San Francisco, the greater San Francisco area, the greater Los Angeles area, the Miami-Dade County area of Florida, and New York City determining the outcome of every presidential election from here on out? I think the Democrats would love that for obvious reasons. But then when you get back to the breakdown by state, breakdown by county, it is clear that when Donald Trump won all but 57 counties in this last election, that there are a lot of folks who would be disenfranchised in every presidential election if, in fact, the Electoral College were to be abolished. Dr. Carson, Clarence Carson, in his book Basic American Government, will give us a far more detailed explanation than what I'm obviously able to do on the air, or in turn able to match Clarence Carson's deep understanding of the American Constitution and how and why it was designed to work the way that it does. But when we talk about abolishing the Electoral College, I would be one to suggest that we should not go there. It could raise other questions as well in regard to a series of other things related to the American Constitution that we've been routinely ignoring as a society for many, many years, chief of which is Article 1, Section 8, in regard to who has the authority to sanction this country to be in a war and who doesn't have that authority. And if that were understood very clearly, we wouldn't be in these circumstances where the neoconservative Zionist element in both of the major political parties that has had such power up to this point is able to facilitate illegal operations like the one that NATO undertook in Libya, the present horror of what the United States has been a full party to with its own illegal actions in Syria. This gets into all kinds of issues, the illegitimate invasion of Iraq to depose Saddam Hussein. It's not insignificant that Fred Reed, the editorial chieftain of the Washington Post, was affirming beyond any shadow of a doubt in his view and in the newspaper's view at that time that we were fully justified in going to war with Saddam Hussein. and getting rid of him because of his possession of weapons of mass destruction. You start thinking about what that tells you about Fred Reed as an executive editor of the Washington Post and as a journalist and a whole host of other people. We might want to take a closer look at why many of these people, I'm going to guess even Mr. Reed himself, although that's not fair because I haven't explicitly read anything that he's written on the subject of the Electoral College, but I would imagine that he certainly is a part of the team that in conjunction with utilizing Soros, or Soros utilizing them, I should say, and all of them subsequently using people like Stein and Sanders and company and Nancy Pelosi and company, elimination of the Electoral College and the movement toward a direct popular vote count alone is the only criterion that should be involved in the election of an American president would have led in this election, in my view, to the absolute guarantee that we would have been at war with Russia in what could have ended life as we know on this planet. So when you start talking about this issue, the Electoral College, or for that matter, tampering with any other aspect of the American Constitution, if we tamper with it where the Electoral College is concerned, I think that would, in my view at least, pave the way for a complete jettisoning of those sections of the American Constitution that the collectivist multinational left doesn't like, which includes, among other things, the Bill of Rights. I think the First and Second Amendments would be very early on their ultimate targets, based upon the way I've assessed their coverage of this last election.
Right. Well, I'm going to give the case. First, I'm going to give the case against the Electoral College.
Sure.
And then I'm going to give a case against the popular vote.
Okay.
And I'm not going to conclude one way or another, but there's issues I want to get out there.
Sure.
So with the Electoral College, I think the biggest problem with it is the way it was set up. The way it was intended, actually, was basically just to be to nominate prominent individuals, and it was assumed that most of the time the Congress would decide from the short list of these prominent individuals. The way it works out is, unless somebody gets a majority of the electoral vote, then Congress chooses between the top three vote getters. And it was assumed that that was usually how it was going to work out. Now, they knew going into the first election that George Washington was going to win. He was overwhelmingly popular, and he, in fact, won unanimously. Both of his elections, he won unanimously, with every single elector voting for him. It wound up not working out that way. There's only been one election where Congress chose between three top finishers. There was another election, the 1800 election, where they finished, where they broke a tie. They were a tiebreaker and won. But it's only worked the way that it was assumed it would work just that one time. Now, the problem is that the Constitution gives the states the ability to determine how to select the electors. Now, in our era, it is through popular vote. They are selected through popular vote, almost always on a statewide basis, although Maine and Nebraska assign two electoral votes to the statewide winner and one electoral vote to the congressional district winners. But even having said that, when I say assigned to the winners, that's not really what it is. It's that each campaign offers a slate of electors, and so you're voting on this slate of electors. And the electors themselves can vote any way they want. Now, some states have made laws that would penalize a elector who was running on the Trump slate or on the Hillary slate from not voting that way. But simply punishing them, saying that they won't be able to run for public office for so long, or maybe have to pay a fine or something like that, that wouldn't stop them from voting faithlessly. That's the term for it, faithlessly. Now there's two or three states that have laws saying that if they vote faithlessly, their vote is nullified and a new elector will be appointed. And that is the only, Michigan might be one of them. It might be Michigan and Minnesota. I'm not sure which two states there are, but it's two or perhaps three that have these kinds of laws. And those are the only laws that have teeth. But for the rest of the states, you could have an elector just voting any way they want. Now, that was something I was worried about and talking a lot about before the election, because I thought there was a possibility that the election would be so close. Now, if, let's just say, Pennsylvania and Michigan wound up going for Hillary instead of for Trump, Trump would have won with one more vote than necessary. He would have had the bare minimum of 270 votes. That would barely be the majority, which would mean if any one of those 270 people voted for somebody besides Trump, it would have sent the election into the Congress to decide. So I think that is a reason to be worried about the Electoral College. And in fact, I think in this election, there are rumors that you're going to see several Hillary electors vote for somebody besides Hillary. And you might say, well, why would they do that? But the idea here is there is a movement to lure away, 37 of Donald Trump's electors or whatever the number winds up being, but I think it would be 37, to vote for somebody else and therefore throw it into to Congress. And by, so the Hillary people are just trying to say, well, you know, let's throw it into the Congress. And so some of them are apparently announcing that they're intending to vote for somebody besides Hillary. So we might see this phenomenon in this election, but you're not going to see 37 Republican electors vote for somebody besides Trump unless something very, very unexpected happens. But I think that is the argument against the Electoral College. I don't think the Electoral College has a pro-Republican or a pro-Democrat bias. I don't think it does. If anything, it has a pro-small state bias, which you were alluding to. But if you think of the small states, some of them are places like Wyoming or North Dakota that are very, very Republican, and some of them are Vermont and Delaware that are very, very Democratic. The argument against the popular vote. Now, I think if we were on a popular vote system, it's very possible Trump would have won. I don't think Trump campaigned in Pennsylvania and Florida and Wisconsin and Michigan because that's where the election was going to be decided. And on a popular vote system, as you said, it would be decided in California and Texas and New York and Florida. And he would have campaigned in those places. The only one of those he did campaign in was Florida, because Florida was a swing state, but the other three weren't. He didn't campaign there. And Trump campaigned very, very effectively. I mean, he won places like Michigan and Pennsylvania that hadn't gone for a Republican in 28 years. And he almost won Minnesota, which hasn't gone for a Republican since 1972, 44 years. So where he campaigned and where he applied his resources, he did very well. And I think had he applied his resources and time to California and New York, he would have done very well there too. And Texas, he could very well have won the popular vote. So I don't think the popular vote per se is biased towards or against Democrats or Republicans. But here is the problem with going to a popular vote. Just as it's under the Electoral College, it's the states that get to decide how to select the electors, it's also the states who get to decide who votes in federal elections. There are some amendments that say they can't, you cannot use gender as to disqualify somebody. You can't use under the age of 21. There's been some amendments that have passed that say you can't use such and such, but it's basically the states that decide. And 230 years ago, when they were drawing up the Constitution, it's been pointed out that slaves weren't expected to vote. But of course, in the late 1700s, you had some states where women voted and some where they didn't. You had states where freed slaves voted. You had states where people without property voted, and some states where you had to have property. They had different requirements. And of course, today, as you alluded, in Virginia, the governor just forced. There had been a law that restricted felons from voting, from ex-felons from voting, and the governor effectively pardoned tens of thousands, somewhere like 50,000 to 80,000 felons who otherwise would not have been able to vote, and suddenly they could vote. And so, all sorts of things like that. Who is allowed to vote? How strictly do you enforce laws? Do you require voter ID? Do you require proof of citizenship in order to register? All of a sudden, these things would become issues more than now. Because now, if California can allow as many illegal aliens as they want to vote, all it does is just kind of, you know, rack up the scoreboard for Hillary, but it doesn't give her any more, it doesn't get her any closer to the White House. She was going to win those 54 electoral votes anyway. 55, I guess it is now. So it's kind of long-winded, but there's problems with both the Electoral College and the popular vote system. And if there's going to be some sort of electoral reform, I think we and everybody needs to know really what are the various pluses and minuses, and not just use as kind of a knee-jerk response what seemed to be beneficial in the last election, because I don't think the Electoral College or the popular vote really has a Democrat or Republican bias. I think it's these other issues that are key. Okay, that was kind of long-winded, and if you would like to respond to that, please do. Otherwise, we can move on to these other issues.
Sure, we can move on. But one other article I would maybe cite that is a fascinating one, because this guy, in my judgment, when you read the article, it's clear that he's not a Trump person. Damon Linker at The Week, the dangerous to deny Trump the presidency. Now, he launches a very interesting and I think quite compelling argument that this current process of trying to get electors to abandon Trump and to switch their support to Clinton when they vote on the 19th of December.
Or to anybody.
Yes, is a horrible idea that's guaranteed to spark a constitutional crisis in the view of this particular writer. I happen to agree with that. He himself opposes, or he supports, I should say, he supports the abolition of the Electoral College, but he argues quite effectively for his particular position from the vantage point that we need to do this after this election is over. For those of us who feel that way, it is a dangerously destabilizing move. I think he effectively argues to be doing this at this point because it would throw the American electoral process and American society into an absolute crisis, the likes of which would make the Watergate controversy of a couple of generations ago an absolute joke by comparison. And he says, in this piece, by all means, work to abolish the Electoral College once the 2018 election is behind us. There are strong arguments for and against making such a change. There's Patrick Slattery, right?
Yeah.
I can buy that. But asking electors to disregard the electoral vote outcome in favor of siding with the popular vote winner this year smacks of an attempted coup.
Yes.
Trump and his supporters would undoubtedly charge that the system is rigged, and they would be right. But he gone to cite a so-called thoughtful liberal pundit and a trio of respected scholars with links to those. He says they floated a similar but more sophisticated argument in favor of hijacking the Electoral College vote, elevating Donald Trump to the presidency. In the view of these people he's citing, constitutes an emergency situation, a moment of existential threat to the public. The Electoral College, he says, was designed to prevent precisely this kind of threat by allowing electors to overrule the popular will when it appeared to ready to empower a potential dictator. So when you read through this, obviously, if 37 electors could be persuaded or could be scared enough, because a lot of these people have gotten death folks, that's a matter of record. If only 37 electors from the states that Trump won joined this effort to switch, the election would be thrown into the House, where a Republican majority can then make the final choice. Right. But he goes on to say that it's crucially important that those of us who are deeply alarmed by the prospect of a President Trump take a stand against this proposal and explain what needs to be forcibly rejected. In a far less significant way, what Damon Linker is saying here at The Week, theweek.com, dovetails with my own sense of things. When I was a Texas State Republican delegate back in 1996, which many of you will remember, was the year of Bob Dole's mm-hmm. nomination. It was the year when Buchanan, the distant second. I've always argued that if we had a better system for financing elections, that's a separate issue. Buchanan might well have been the Republican nominee that year, but be that as it may, someone came to me, I won't use their name over the air, someone in a position with the kind of clout in the Republican Party in Texas to do it, and they said to me, hey, by the way, I'd love to have you in San Diego, he said. And I said, well, I'm going out there to attend a couple of Buchanan's private parties and you know, just to tour the sights of San Diego, so to speak, and to see old friends. And he said, no, he said, I mean, as a delegate to the Republican National Convention in San Diego, representing Texas. And we talked about that a little bit. And, of course, in Texas, as he explained it to me at the time, and this individual who was explaining this to me was a very high-powered legal mind, as well as a political activist in the Republican Party in this state, he was saying, the one thing, he said, the party rules here in Texas, of course, would bind you to vote for Bob Dole in San Diego. And I told him, I said, well, I said that's clearly out. I said I would not cast a ballot for Bob Dole. Therefore, don't even consider me. But I did go on to say, and this I think has some pertinence to what you've been saying, Patrick, about this whole issue of electors and the way in which the many of these people are not bound. It depends on the state to determine whether or not they're bound to vote the way their state voted in the popular presidential election. But I told this fellow, you know, he said, I said, if I could go out there with the legal right, the technical legal right to vote for Buchanan out there, I still would not do that, because Dole won the Texas primary. The majority of the people here in this arena, the Alamo Dome in San Antonio, by the way, they want Dole is their nominee. And I said, if I went out there, whether I was bound to do so or not, I would vote for Dole, because the people of this state in the Republican Party have spoken, and I would respect that, despite the fact that I have little or no use for Bob Dole. Buchanan was clearly my candidate. I said, it's not only something that involves being legally bound, but I would reject this very kind offer even if I wasn't legally bound, because there is something to me that inherently would seem unfair mm-hmm. to what the people of my party in this state wants, wrong as I think they are, the majority of them, wrong as I think they are, to pick Dole over Buchanan. Nonetheless, even if I could get away with it and could go out there and cast a defiant ballot for Buchanan at the Republican National Convention, I know that that's not right. In my own mind, it wouldn't be right. And I wouldn't be a party to that either. But I said, for the record, between us, it's a private conversation. It's not going to be in the newspapers or known to anybody else that you've approached me. I would not go out there as a delegate to the Republican National Convention, mm-hmm. because I'm going out there to have a little bit of fun and to get over a case of indigestion that I've had ever since Dole clearly was going to be the nominee of the Republican Party. But I think that you're identifying something that really needs to be tied up if the Electoral College is maintained, and that is to look at this whole issue of the what can effectively be argued is the need to bind the electors of that state to reflect the popular vote will mm-hmm. of the people of their state.
Right, because in many, if not most states, the electors, the party's electors, are decided on before the nominee, the presidential nominee, is decided on.
And yes.
So many of these electors were anti-Trump people, perhaps even never Trump people. Okay, well, let's move on to the cabinet appointments, and in particular, Secretary of State. As of the recording of this show, that is still up in the air. There are people who are talking about Romney. There's a Never Romney movement. The other people are talked about, like Giuliani's talked about a lot. There's, some other names that are out there, and also a Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard that I wrote about earlier. So what are your thoughts on this Secretary of State position and any other Trump cabinet position?
Well, clearly, the people that produce videos for Russian-oriented websites grasp this thing in the same way that I do, for better or worse. Russia Insider has a rather humorous and yet very serious video of 33 seconds entitled, "Can Trump Get Along with Russia If He Appoints Bolton or Giuliani?" Mm-hmm. I think we could add Romney to that mix as well, along with a host of other neocon types who are household names in the Republican Party to that list. And that would include Petraeus, too, in regard mm-hmm. to what I think is basic orientation as an interventionist.
Yeah, I mean, that's my instinct about Petraeus. Petraeus, regarding Russia, regarding Syria, has he made recent statements that we should know about and be alarmed at or be assured
by? If he
has,
I'm not aware of them.
Okay.
I would have to go back and do some additional research on that. You know, as I evaluate the national security team that we know about thus far, to me the most alarming choice thus far is the gentleman picked to be the head of the CIA in
right.
a Trump
Pompeo.
Administration.
What's that?
Yes.
Congressman Pompeo.
The congressman from the 4th Congressional District in Canada.
Kansas.
Canada. Kansas, sorry. It's been a long night for me.
Yeah, we haven't made Canada great yet again. We're going to make America great, and then we're going to make Canada America again.
Yeah, we'll make America great again by sending Pompeo out of Kansas and into Canada or into Mexico or any other third country where he wishes to go. But clearly for those of us, which is many of us, who voted for Donald Trump with all of his flaws and warts that are, you know, that we acknowledge are there, we did so on the basis of the fact that he was the only choice, and I talked about this yesterday privately with a Catholic priest who admitted to me that he voted for Trump. You know, we don't want any more of these globalist wars. And this underscores South Front's video, which I talked about at the beginning of the show. People need to look at that. Trump's USA, Global America, or Fortress America. That 8 minutes gives you an overview of what is at stake, not only in the general election that we had on November 8th. It has everything to do with these ongoing attempts on the part of the Zionist neoconservative nexus in this country to infiltrate and to hijack a Trump presidency. Wayne Madsen, of course, known to many of us, has one out there with Russia Insider entitled "Blasts from the Past Threaten to Undermine Trump Presidency." A number of other people have been sounding that same theme, and clearly what's involved here would be a most tragic missed opportunity on the part of Donald Trump if one of these neoconservative people with very clear and very ugly track records were to be put into the position of being a Secretary of State in a Trump presidency. The lady from Hawaii that you cite,
Tulsi Gabbard.
How is her last name pronounced?
Well, I'm saying Gabbard. It's an English name. You can look up Gabbard on the internet, and you see there's a coat of arms for it. It's a traditional English name, not particularly common, but it's English.
Yes.
T-U-L-S-I, Tulsi. Her mother, who is also apparently English descent, but had gotten involved in Hinduism, so I assume Tulsi might be an Indian name. She has a little bit of Samoan ancestry. I would think it's probably 1/8 because it's from her father's side. Her father, if you look at his face, he looks like he has a... I mean, with her, you look at her face and she looks European. He looks like he has, a little bit of Polynesian. And he's a local politician in Hawaii. He has his own Wikipedia page. And you look at his parents, both his parents have completely English names. He was born in American Samoa. And so if one of his parents was pure Samoan, they wouldn't have an entirely English name. So my guess is that she probably has one of her great-grandmothers is probably Samoan. But in Hawaii, I don't mean to interrupt you for so long, but in Hawaii, there's a great deal of value in emphasizing any Polynesian ancestry you have. There's a
yes.
great deal of value, if for nothing else, so that when you're in school, you don't get beat up.
Yeah, I went to a Lutheran parochial school as a child in Hawaii for 3 years in a relatively protected environment in terms of those kinds of tensions, because most of the kids, not all of them, but most of them, were the sons of Army and Navy and Air Force personnel in Hawaii. But I saw more of what you were talking about in my junior year in Honolulu, where I was at Iolani School, which is a marvelous academic institution.
I'm familiar with it.
Yes, and I went to Iolani 1 year, but that was in the early 70s, my earlier experience in Hawaii.
Did you learn how to say, oh, I know Halibra, I'm one Portuguese?
No, I learned to say that in German,
That means I'm not white, I'm Portuguese, because the Portuguese get a pass, because they were there early.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, wir machen Amerika groß wieder. That's what I learned over there. But anyway, looking at this whole issue when I was at Iolani, I clearly saw the kinds of racial tensions that have existed in the Hawaiian Islands for a long time, and that has a whole other story to it. But then, as far as talking about the Tulsi Gabbard or Gabbard name being floated as a Secretary of State in a Trump administration, I sent a tweet. I use Twitter for nothing else, but I've used it to communicate with Trump's transition team. And I basically said, hey, the people at large have voted for Mr. Trump, and I'm one of them. We don't want any of these neoconservatives or interventionists or radical Zionists in this position. And I said, give us Pat Buchanan, which I knew that's not in the mix, but I said this for a reason. I said, give us Pat Buchanan or Tulsi Gabbard or Gabbard. In other words, I was trying to tell them something with that, and that is, hey, we got people. I understand that as would be the case in Hawaii, which is a solidly Democrat state for the most part. I don't know how years ago Hiram Fong, the old Republican U.S. Senate guy, got elected as many years as he did in a state like Hawaii. But nonetheless, Hawaii is overwhelmingly a partisan Democratic state. The Congress lady, Gabbard or Gabbard, in many respects, I understand, represents a point of view on the left that would not be shared by me, at least, and probably at least some, if not all of it, by you either. But one of my close friends, who is the grandson of a person that I've worked with in alternative media for years before he passed away, said to me recently, you know, this woman is, as he put it, she's a communist. That's the way he put it. She's a communist, and she, all the different things. Her foreign policy's fine, but she believes in X, Y, and Z. I've never researched that, by the way. I'm taking
well,
that
you know,
at face.
I don't mean to interrupt you, but her father in particular, but also herself when she was in the state legislature, were campaigners against gay marriage.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I did not know that.
And she gets criticized by those on the so-called left for that.
Well, the thing that is, I look at this, we're talking about this lady to be Secretary of State, where her positions, as I understand, the public positions, are exactly what people like I have been saying on the anti-globalist right for years. I think she would be a terrific choice, not simply in that she would represent the views of so many people that did vote for Donald Trump, but I also think what you have here would be a potential political coup for Trump to actually put a congresswoman, a Democratic congressman, a congresswoman from Hawaii into that Secretary of State position. It would throw a complete monkey wrench, it seems to me, into not only the knee-jerk neocon Zionist control of all of this in the past in both the major political parties in terms of who gets these national security choices, but what it would say is that Trump would be sending a signal to many people, not only his supporters, but also to the Russians, among others, and to the Iranians and others, that, hey, this is the dawning of a new age in terms of the fact that we are going to pull back from this neocon, globalist, interventionist foreign policy that has all of us, including my own country, at the brink of destruction. And here you have it. And I'm willing to put a Democratic congresswoman from Hawaii who gets the big picture on this. I'm putting her in the position of being the Secretary of State, not Bolton, not Giuliani, not Mitt Romney or Petraeus or any of these other people that I think ideologically on the basic issues of war and peace and what the role of the American military and national security establishment should be. These folks do not need to be rewarded for all of their past mistakes by putting any of them in a Trump administration at that level. I think this Gabbard choice or Gabbard choice would be a terrific appointment, not only in the merits of what she believes in the area of foreign policy, but I think it would have the Democrats absolutely stammering over the fact that a woman, a Democratic woman, their own elected officials from the Hawaiian Islands, of all things, would suddenly be the point person for Trump's foreign policy. I think it would be a terrific pick.
That's right. And she had been a Sanders supporter. And I think it also is a signal to the Sanders people that Trump really embodies their foreign policy ideals even better than Sanders did, frankly.
Well, absolutely. And to me, I'll tell you right now that this was my initial idea. Nothing has changed my mind on this up to this point. I think Gabbard or Gabbard would be the absolutely best choice, absolutely the best choice of any of the people whose names have even peripherally been mentioned in regard to a significant role in the Trump administration. In this case, we're talking about the Secretary of State job, which obviously seems to be, you know, it's taking the longest to name that particular pick. I think this reflects a struggle within the Republican Party and a struggle within Trump's transition team and a struggle within the whole Trump machine over whether or not he is really going to revamp this country's foreign policy along cohesive and sane America First lines and parameters, or whether he's going to make the mistake, which I'm afraid he will make. I hope he doesn't. But we don't need any of these other people, especially Bolton. Mm. I think Bolton is the worst of the lot. Mm-hmm. And then relatively speaking, you can put Giuliani and Romney and Petraeus in a bag and shake them up with a flour in it and basically come out with something that's the usual mix.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we're starting to, you know, run up towards the end of the show, but we still have the issue of fake news.
Yes.
Would you like to address this recent creation of the notion of fake news and then applying it to people like us rather than to the alternative media that really deserves it?
Absolutely, and I think when we look at this whole business of fake media, This is where we get back to a couple of these articles that were so well done, that were absolutely critical, scathingly critical of the trash that the Washington Post put out on Russian agents in American media and American alternative media. They're focusing on the alternative media here. Can we really believe that Dr. Philip Giraldi, the two-time or more CIA station chief in a couple of different locations, consistent critic of Israel, by the way, he's the chairman of the Council for the National Interest, that he would be fronting for Russia and fronting for news sites that were Russian fronts? This is inherently ludicrous. And the Washington Post has absolutely defamed, and in my judgment, for all practical intents and purposes, at least morally, if not legally, morally libeled antiwar.com. They have libeled Consortium News. They have libeled Ron Paul, the longtime Republican congressman from Texas and libertarian, who has been one of the most effective critics, who's still out there as an effective critic of this neoconservative, this dangerous neoconservative interventionist ideology. Does anyone believe, can anyone possibly believe that Ron Paul or his Institute on Liberty are a Russian front, and that they, that he and Phil Giraldi and Paul Craig Roberts and all of these other folks are deliberately taking Russian money, that they are deliberately mouthpieces for Vladimir Putin and so forth and so on? This is so inherently ridiculous that for the Washington Post to stoop to such transparently disprovable nonsense, writing articles like this that you wouldn't use to line the bottom of a birdcage, frankly, does anyone take any of this seriously? And to me, the crux of the issue is that the Washington Post cites the authoritative character of an organization, a so-called foreign policy think tank, or sort of an inside the beltway insider's thing, supposedly, PROP or not. Who has heard of PROP or not? We don't know where they're where they really are, how long they've been in business. Nobody's heard of them before. No one knows who their executive director is. No one knows who they might have on a so-called board of directors. No one knows a single thing about this organization, PROP or not. And yet, as Giraldi underscores in his piece, the Washington Post is using an unknown organization with no specific provable names attached to it to say all kinds of things. Well, the Putin, the evidence is strong that Putin rigged the election, or Putin hacked computers in certain states, or Putin was behind the hacking of the computers of the Democratic National Committee, or Putin is secretly financing Consortium News, whose total annual budget, as Robert Perry pointed out in his rebuttal of this, is only $200,000, folks. I mean, come on here, right? But we are supposed to believe that antiwar.com, Ron Paul, consortiumnews.com, and people like Phil Giraldi, people like Paul Craig Roberts, people like Robert Perry are Russian agents or apologists or useful tools in conveying Putin's propaganda scheme. And, of course, this is now underscoring the hysteria of the mainstream media in the United States, because their credibility was absolutely destroyed with the results of this election. And when they stoop to this kind of thing, if they had even an ounce of credibility left, that's evaporating very quickly. And I think the Washington Post, to trash like this, has reached an all-time low in journalistic integrity and legitimacy that I don't think they're ever going to recover from. I mean, this
let's
is
hope
just
not.
Yeah, let's hope not. And clearly, it gets into the very thing that you and I talked about in our last show together, Patrick, and that is the Atlantic cover story of November, where Jeffrey Goldberg, the longtime Israeli Defense Force Palestinian detention camp guard, who is now the executive director of the Atlantic, comes out with this cover story on the weaponization of social media. It shows a dove with a hand grenade strapped to it. And in that particular situation with the Atlantic, which we discussed in our last show, who are the people who the Atlantic very skillfully tars? The so-called foreign policy experts, who at least are named by name, right? Mm-hmm. We have to give them that much. They name the names and where they work, and enough that we know that these people even exist. But the Atlantic at least cited its sources for the story. But it was obvious that the chief targets were Russian media and the American alternative right. That, to me, is a very revealing roadmap that I am going to suggest is not only where the Atlantic is headed with this sort of thing, but the Washington Post and all of and CNN and MSNBC and all of these other people that we have come to have absolute contempt for are all singing out of the same page and the same hymnal. And when people understand this, if they will avail themselves of people like Phil Giraldi and Paul Roberts and Ron Paul and Tom DeWeese and all these other folks, they will get it. We can only pray that they get it through time, both in what has been shown by this election and its results and its outcome, and the way in which these folks from here on out, as bad as they've been up to this point, are going to stoop to all new low levels in regard to doing anything that they can do to regain their assumed credibility and to strengthen their grip that has been significantly loosened with the Brexit vote in the UK, now with the Trump victory in the United States. The next thing they're terrified about is going to be Marine Le Pen's possible election as the next president of France. They're terrified of this Frauke Petri, the head of the Alternative for Deutschland party there. They are clearly sweating over the near election of a right-wing candidate to be the next president of Austria. He just missed this go-around. Hofer, I think, is his name. Mm-hmm. So you start looking at this bigger picture. The entire global new world order that these folks front for and work for and get paid handsomely to represent, we're dealing with a whole new set of potential presuppositions here, a whole new set of possible outcomes. Trump will do what he has to do, which includes bringing these lapdogs for Israel, these lapdogs for the banks, these lapdogs for the cultural Marxists, these lapdogs for the global trade treaty advocates, absolutely to heel and to continue exposing them. I would say that Trump, advisedly now, Trump needs not only to make some decent picks like Gabbard or Gabbard for Secretary of State, but Trump, when these guys hit as low below the belt as they already have, and where that's clearly going to escalate, I think South Front's video is quite instructive on this, the one we talked about here, this is going to get even lower and dirtier and uglier and more evil than it already is. And when it does, Trump is going to have to return the fire, return the punches responsibly, and get the American people on his bandwagon in a way that that they're afraid he might just do now that he is on the verge of being installed legitimately as the President of the United States.
Thank you, Reverend Mark Dankoff, and this is Patrick Slattery signing off until another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.